Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Michael Robinson, 10 years of career experience, a captain on Engine 313 with Lexington County Fire Services, assistant cadre member for Soda City Training and Hornet Fire Training. Michael never had aspirations of being a firefighter. As a veteran of the armed forces and a professional MMA fighter, upon completing his services, he was trying to find a career that would align with what he was used to, such as being on a team, camaraderie, and a sense of purpose. Michael had a friend suggest he try the fire department, and once he did, the rest is history. Listen to Michael talk, and you can clearly hear how being around the right individuals and attending outside training can make a huge difference in your career and mindset. With that, I present Mr. Michael Robinson.
All right, my name is Michael Robinson, and as far as how I got into fire service, I was kind of like a late starter. So I was 31 when I joined. Coming out of high school, I barely graduated. So the biggest career path for me at that point was to join the Army. Had a recruiter come to my house. Wasn't sure what I was going to do. Didn't have a direction. Like I said, I was barely graduating. Like, I went to a secondary school in my senior year and everything. So went to the Army, did about 8 years there, did a couple of combat deployments to Iraq, met my wife. She was in the Army as well. She just retired from the reserves in the past month. And then obviously I had my two kids while I was in the Army. And then coming out of the Army, I knew I wanted to leave. I knew I did, or I had re-enlisted like a couple times. So I knew I wanted to leave. I wasn't sure what career path I wanted to take, which was, in hindsight, a mistake, you know, but I was young. I was kind of immature. I was still learning and figure out where I wanted to go. And I didn't have that safety net anymore in the Army. So from there, I just decided I was going to go to school. And weirdly enough, I decided I was going to start fighting MMA. So within my last probably 1 to 2 years, I'd say about 2 years in the Army, I started training MMA. I started doing jiu-jitsu, and I started almost right away doing amateur MMA fights. And getting out of the Army, I knew I wanted to continue doing that. That was when, again, I mean, I started late in that, but I was in my mid-20s, you know, super optimistic. I thought I was going to fight in the UFC and make a lot of money. You know, I knew I had the work ethic and desire to do it. And I did that for a couple years. And you start realizing the money just really isn't there for that stuff. It's just not happening. Now, I was going to school at the same time. Eventually I got a master's degree while I was still in the fire service. But at that time, I'd already been going to school, taking advantage of the GI Bill. And I was trying to look for something to kind of stabilize things for me, because one of the things I lost when I left the Army was that stabilizing, the fact that I had that consistent paycheck, the benefits, kind of a career, something, goals moving forward, something that kind of provided that, I won't say safety net, but like that cushion, like, you know, I could just have something to rely on so I could live my life. And also just for my family, right? You know, I'm married with two kids, like we need to provide for each other. So I started looking into the fire service. Of course, like most military guys, if you don't know, most military guys, especially combat MOSs like I was, because I was a combat engineer, one of the things you look into is like police or fire. Like, it's like the two options you look into, like, what am I going to do? I don't know. I guess I'll be a cop. I guess I'll be a firefighter. So that's why you see a lot of ex-military guys in those professions, especially police. But the more I looked at it, I really wasn't interested in being in law enforcement. So I started looking at the fire service. I knew a couple guys who were already doing it. A buddy of mine named Sam King was working at the Columbia Airport. He was in a dual role as a firefighter and as a police officer. And he was kind of leaning on me. And then if you pay attention to like MMA, kickboxing, you see guys who do firefighting. And I started realizing that for me, who was still interested in MMA at the time, it was really appealing to me to have that type of schedule for training. So like that 24 on, 48 off, which was, you know, the common schedule, like I found that very appealing. So eventually I got an opportunity and an application opened up for Lexington County. I think my buddy who was also looking to do the same thing, who was also a professional MMA fighter, Tim Goodwin, he was also looking at it too for that stabilizing factor. And I joined in Lexington and got on, went to the recruit class, and right away, I realized like it was what I was really missing. You know, I got that, you know, there was parts that I'm not one of those people that says, oh, I missed the Army. It was the best time of life. I'm appreciative of what it gave me because it gave me the opportunity coming up poor in a poor household in a small town. Like it gave me opportunities, especially as somebody who had no direction to kind of find my life and to kind of grow as a person to where I'm at right now. But I don't miss it per se, but there's aspects I missed. And there was a camaraderie and the friendship, you know, the brotherhood we always talk about so much. And I was like, man, I really like these dudes. These are some good dudes that I'm working with right here. And starting in recruit class, I started to realize everything was skill-based. And for me, like that was too easy, you know, just going in there, learn the skills, pounding up reps. As somebody who did martial arts, who did MMA and specifically Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, like doing those repetitions, refining them skills made so much sense to me. To me, it was almost too easy in some ways because like I just got work at this. I find the small details, I work at the skill, and I can master it. And just going through that and finding a sense of what I was doing really mattered. You know, when I was deployed, like those were times, and I hate to be that guy that like loved combat so much because there's some really negative parts about deployments and just the inherent risk of an actual combat deployment. But when I was on missions, when we were actually getting things done, you know, I did like I guess you'd call it counter IED, or you know, route clearance as we called it then, or maybe you still call it now. You know, finding IEDs, like I felt like I was having a real tangible effect on what we were doing, like on those deployments. I thought what we were doing really mattered. You know, sometimes you get in ambushes, close attacks and everything like that. And I felt like, okay, in those moments, I felt like I was at my best. And so when I started doing things in recruit class, and especially when I hit the floor and I got in my what I would call my first real interior structure fire, and I had those moments of like just the action, that excitement, you know, everything was mattering. It was all adding up, you know, going through real serious like crashes. Like, I think one of my first, you know, like real bad medical calls was a motorcycle ejection. I felt like everything was coming together. And to have those things and those, it all mattered. And to be around the people I did, I mean, it was like another home for me. Like, I realized this is what I was missing. I can't do anything else. Like, this is. Until retirement, like this is what I want to do. I love every aspect of the job. Just the fact that what we do matters so much. And I think guys forget that sometimes. They get so jaded and they get so jaded and bitter about what, you know, things happening to them, whether it's the career, whether it's headquarters sent to a bad assignment. They take things personally and then they just kind of, you know what? I'm not gonna, without saying it, they're just gonna fall off. You know, they're gonna stop doing what they need to do. They're gonna stop training. They're gonna everything. Because why does it matter? This is gonna keep on happening to me again and again. And you're forgetting what you're doing this for. You're doing this for the citizens. Like what we do matters so much and it's so important. So once I hit that, like once I got into the profession, that was it for me. I realized like, oh, this is what I was looking for. I mean, all reality, I wish I would have started sooner. I wish I wouldn't have taken those couple of years off, like post Army to do MMA to go into firefighting, but I just didn't know. And maybe it wouldn't have been good for me. You know, we were in a different place. The organization was in a different place during that time frame. I was still a little bit younger. You know, maybe I would have made some bad decisions. You know, maybe I would have fallen into like an older crowd who would have been embittered by a change. I don't know. Maybe this all worked out the way it was supposed to. And I think that's what happened. So even starting at 31, like I'm okay with how it all turned out. I had to work to that point to find my way to get there. And now that I'm here, like I couldn't be happier. And every day, you know, even at 41, it's all about getting better, being involved in the process and trying to mentor and grow those around you. Also important to me. This job is literally everything. I mean, I'm saying platitudes right now, but it really does matter. So
No,
that's where I'm at now.
as that's definitely well said, man, for sure. And I'm a firm believer everything happens for a reason, whether you want to agree with what occurs or not. Like, it's divine intervention. It's what was written for you, and you just got to go with it. So even though you started in late, I truly believe it happened the way it was supposed to.
Yep, that's right. So, I mean, I'm happy to be here. Like, I feel so blessed sometimes, because you really look back on what, your life and the some of the bad decisions you make, the good decisions you make. You just look at where those things could have went. And then, like, I'm just so appreciative of where I'm at right now, because I know, like, I've struggled along the way, like a lot of, people do, like a lot of guys do, trying to find our way, trying to find our path. And, like, I'm happy, like, the profession really is a blessing for, how I am as a person. So,
Okay. With that being said, one of the topics you wanted to kind of hit on, which I think goes perfectly with what you were saying, personal growth within the profession and how to generally be successful at what you do. What advice can you give to any other individual out there who's just coming into the game or has been there a while and maybe they've hit a rut because it happens to the best of us?
yeah, so one of the things I learned, and I already touched on a little bit when I talked about recruit class and everything about the skills, is we forget that the skills that we do, like those ladder throws, those hose stretches, forcible entry, all those things, those are skills that are meant to be mastered. I think guys forget to revisit those skills because, for various reasons, and I think it's a huge mistake. Those skills are meant to be mastered, and I say they can be mastered. Now, what I also say is they can't be perfected, and that's not to say don't ever do them. I'm just saying you can master them, not perfect them, because there's always something you can work on and improve at. Even as somebody who is known to have a reputation for stretching a lot of lines, like, and I stretch lines as much as I can. I try to teach others. That's why I'm so one of my biggest things in the organization to try to influence it was our hose loads. We spent the past year working on changing the entire hose loads for the county. And in order to get to that point, in order to influence the change, you have to develop the requisite knowledge. And part of that is just building up those reps, getting that mileage in, stretching, thousands of foot of hose, for my example, so you realize too, there was nobody better than you, or maybe not anybody better, but, like, as far as your organization, you're one of the guys where people come to you for that. Where they're like, hey, like, I want to get better at this. How do I do it? Like, oh, and we can talk as long as you want to. And I know the why of it. Like, I think that's one of the things. Once you get better at the skills, you have to understand the why of it. And you've been in Nozzle Ford, right? We've talked about, we were in the same Nozzle Ford with Aaron Fields. And that's one of things that Aaron was so big about. He's like, guys talk about these skills. Like, they talk about, like, they go back to their organization and they want to show everybody how to knee slide, how to knee walk, and all that. That's great, but you have to be able to understand why, explain why, because that's how you sell it. For those people who are immediately aren't going to go, oh wow, that's really cool. Like, oh wow, look at that knee walk. Getting down low, that makes a lot of sense. Some guys can be like, well, why do I need to do this? If you're like, because it's really good and it works really well, they're going to be like, okay, I'm done listening to you. All right, you need to, in order to influence that change, you have to understand the why of it. And as you get into that position, right, then you get opportunities for, then start looking at opportunities for, like, committees or memberships within the organization. So it took me years and years and years to, we have, like, for example, like a lot of organizations, pretty much any sufficiently sized organization, we have equipment committees, right? So in the equipment committee, I was never felt like I was ready for it, so I was like, because I didn't really understand what they were doing. A lot of it seemed apparatus based for us, and I'm like, well, I'm just not that guy for it. Like, I'm not a mechanic, I'm not mechanically built, like, I don't it doesn't seem to place for me. But then you realize that equipment goes much more beyond that. But I had to understand where I was going, what I was doing, the why of it, to get into the committee and make an influence, so that way when I'm going up there and I say, we need to do these hose loads, like, we need to switch to this, it's again, it's not be just because it's better and you kind of like put your hands down, because again, they're not going to buy into it. Buy-in is so important for what we do. If you're going to influence change, you have to have that buy-in. So when I went into the equipment committee to do that, I had to have that knowledge base. So build up that knowledge base, and that starts with you doing the reps, but then also comes into the course of doing the research into the equipment you're using. One of the things I tell the engine guys, and as I branch out and I started teaching more and more, I've helped with Soda City, I've helped with Hornet Fire training. One of the things I talk about is like we go in there, we show all these skill-based things. And I was like, we need to start thinking for engine guys, we need to start thinking about like truckies, right? A truck guy is going to tell you why the halogen is this length, why the hook is this length, like what the leverage points are. They're going to know why the saw is this type of saw with this specs on it, why it's effective for roofs, and why this type of saw is effective for this. Why do you need a Lincoln bar? Like what they're going to be able to explain these things. And engine guys, sometimes it's just all skill-based. And you need to know your hose loads in and out, the capabilities of them. You need to know the hose and the nozzles that are attached to them. Why are you getting those different specs? Like looking up guys like Dennis LeGear. Like Dennis LeGear is a good resource. And so some people can view his like information as a little dense, but if you really sit down and read it, it's really digestible and really informative. You build that knowledge base, then you start understanding why. You get into these committees and you start influencing change. And that's how you do it. Like, because at a certain point, nobody can disagree with you. They can try, but it's just at a certain point, it's just like, okay, what am I going to actually be able to change your mind on this? Or are we just wasting both of our times right now? Because if I explained to you 25 different ways why this, and I, even when I went out and we started changing the hose loads, if I say 25 different reasons why this hose load is better, and then you're like, well, it's not bi-directional, somebody can't do it. Well, you're just trying to stop the change, and we're both wasting each other's times. I win, like whether you like that or not. So you have to really build a knowledge base, understand why, and then get yourself into positions. And that's really organization dependent, right? So you're working Mooresville, right? So I don't know how big Mooresville is. So, but Lexington, we're about right now, and we're constantly growing. So 300 personnel, approximately 25 stations, and then lots of mutual and automatic aids around us with smaller departments like KC, West Columbia, Irmo, and even to some degree, Columbia themselves. And for us in that large organization, like for me, the opportunity existed if I got promoted to officer. Now, it's not the only reason I promoted to officer, but I knew within the scope of our organization, being a captain, because that's our first officer position. We don't have lieutenants. It goes firefighter, engineer, captain for us. That was an opportunity. I was going to put myself in that position. So position one, being on those committees, for example, and then position two, as far as rank goes, for me, being an officer, specifically a captain, allow me to influence change. Now, not every organization is like that. You might have to go to battalion chief, and then we got to be careful. Because if we're in a rush to go to battalion chief or whatever, the white helmet position is for us, that could be a huge mistake. And I think guys really, they sometimes are part of the problem by trying to promote way too fast to white helmet. I think you could stand for some real experience and seasoning, especially at certain positions. Experience is too relevant, too important. And I think some guys think I'm put training over experience. I definitely do not. Definitely do not. Like experience is where that's a foundation of everything that you do. You base your decisions A off of your training, B off your experience, and C off your ability to problem solve. All right. You only could control the training, but experience you have to gather is so relevant. So that's where I stand with that. Developing the knowledge base, understanding why you do those things that you do. And then get yourself into those positions, whether it's through committees or whether it's through actually being in a promoted position. And then for me, now that I'm at a captain, I'm gonna tell you, I'm gonna enjoy the fruits of that labor. Like I'm gonna now that change is happening, I'm staying right here for a while. Like now I get to run a company, I get the hose as I want, I get the potential equipment that I want if I keep on working on that change, and I'm happy. I'm happy. And now the organization's moving in a direction. It all depends. me and my buddy, a guy named Brian Dunlap, he's a firefighter. Me and him, as far as engine work goes, we talk all the time about this stuff. And if you're in a small organization, change can be easy depending on those around you and the size of the organization and who's in what position. If you're in a large organization, it's going to kind of move like a barge, but that doesn't mean it can't happen. It just means it's going to take some work. And sometimes, JJ from Soda City, like he'll tell you this, and I think he borrowed this from Aaron Fields because I heard Aaron say the same thing about water boiling from the bottom up. And I agree with it because like you could be, the most knowledgeable guy, but at a certain point, if you're constantly advocating for change, then you sound like a malcontent. And you got to be careful because then but if you build up people around you and you influence those guys who are excited for the job, who are coming in, who are asking those questions, and then they're going to pass it on, like then that's when change starts happening. Things start building up. So when you go in front of those committees, it might not be the first time they've heard it. You might, matter of fact, on that committee, you might have an advocate or two who are there right there with you. So when you say this, they chime in with you. My operations chief, I knew him. Because he came to our organization with a lot of prior experience. He came in initially as a firefighter and well, in our organization, mind you, and obviously when he started, he came as a firefighter, but in our organization, he started as a firefighter. And me and him had a lot of these long conversations and he got to be exposed to some of the engine schools. So in a lot of ways, he's been an advocate too. You'd be surprised at how much that influence around you really matters. And how much influencing others and affecting that change in an organization, it comes to fruition when you do that. So that'd be about like my best recommendations.
Okay. All right. And so upon finishing recruit class, rookie school, whatever you want to call it, and getting assigned to a company, with your background of being in the military, did you try to find those people you wanted to emulate, or did you kind of have to work your way through to find the people that you wanted to be like?
Yeah, so like I got exposed to it took me a long time to be exposed to things I wanted to be exposed to because I was looking for okay, so when it comes like again, I'm going to default back to hose stretching. So I was always confused when I joined the organization about why, I felt like coming from martial arts is a good comparison. Like martial arts, especially Brazilian jiu-jitsu, like I was always an advocate of like mastering the basics, right? And like, so why are we going to these fire academy schools, fire academy classes to build up our packets for, whatever we're going to do, whether it's a special ops team or for promotion? We could be doing this right here at the company level. Like all the things we do in a fire ground, we could practice within the station. Why are we not doing this more? And that was very frustrating for me. And it took, and I was looking for those type of people who kind of like promoted that mindset. I was like, where are these guys at? And this is where I learned, and as you've been exposed to, I'm sure, is you go, once you start doing, and you hear this all the time on podcasts. You start going to outside training, outside conferences, and then it's just you're surrounded by these people who are like that. You're like, whoa, like the okay, this really, there's a lot of people out here like this. And for me, I'm just looking up his name because I hate mispronouncing his name. But JJ, he was okay, there it is. Jason Joannidis, like he was, so important for me. And I try to tell him this all the time, and I don't know if he believes me or not because I get on a lot and I pick on him a lot. But he came over to us to be our training captain, and right away he was like, "Let's set up some training." He sent emails to the floor. Let's set up some training. Let's do some things. Let's come up. And I was like, "Man, let's go ahead and do this." And I'm within a day, I was emailing him back. I was like, I'm coming up here. Here's the paperwork. Here's the form. Let's set up multiple dates. And I remember, it was literally me and my firefighter at the time, Dustin Durham. And I was an engineer on a two-person truck. And we'd come up there and I'd be like, let's work on these things. And we would do them. And then he exposed me to outside training. He brought in people to the organization that weren't for, again, for me, the Fire Academy classes, they just wasn't it. Like it did, it was just not something that appealed to me. It felt very, curriculum was good, but it felt like, it was IFSTA stuff. It was IFSTA manuals. It was very like, everything was by the book. And by the book has its place, especially if the material is good material. But then he brought Jonah Smith in from Warrant Fire Training. And Jonah, I don't know if you met or trained with Jonah, but man, he changed everything for me. Getting exposed to Jonah's stuff, like just from his initial speech, and I wish I could be so good about as he was about just firing everybody up. His opening speech, I was like, oh man, like I really like the stuff this guy's saying. And everything we did was just about what I now know to be engine work. But at the time, I didn't know. To me, it was all firefighting, truck work, engine work. Oh, it's just all firefighting. And then I realized, no, there are specialties, and it doesn't have to be special ops. You can just literally be a truck guy. You can just literally be an engine guy and be really, really, really good at that because the profession is so big. Like, think about all you cannot be good at everything we do in this profession. Think about all the things that we do, the tech rescue, water, hazmat, all those things, engine work, truck work, auto extrication. It's you cannot be good at everything. And I realized in that moment that these guys had just invested a lot of time in the engine work, and they were out there stretching lines for hours, out there moving the hose around for hours. And I was like, man, this is perfect. This is exactly what I was looking for. And these are the mentors that I'm looking for right here. And it's not to say there wasn't mentors in the organization, because there are. There's guys I talk to this day that I met on day one, But as far as what I was looking for, which was the better training, the better skill work, running into JJ and then Jonah in turn was career changing. And it took me 5 to 6 years to reach that point. To finally find those people. So these things can take a long time to develop depending on how you get exposed to them. But oh man, I'm so grateful for them, because once I got exposed to them, I knew what direction of my career was going. I knew what I was going to work on, and it just took off. So JJ and Jonah, top dudes. And then there's other people I met from there, but just those two people were initially exposing me. And I still reach out to to this day. Texting Jonah, calling Jonah, texting JJ, calling him when he answers and he knows what I'm talking about. It's been a blessing. So yeah, those people are so valuable to you, especially when you get into the profession and you're looking for a direction, because it's hard to find a direction on your own without those people influencing you, bouncing ideas off of them and showing you what right is and the right direction to move in.
Definitely, 100%, 100%, factual statement there. Okay. In your opinion, how should one your question of how to improve your organization and be an overall asset, how does one go about doing that? Because like you said, sometimes people don't know their fullest potential, what they can actually bring to the table until they find that person that kind of gets that out of them. But what would you tell somebody how they could be an asset either to the organization or even if it's a small thing as your crew?
Yeah, so I think in that example, you got to find your niche and your specialty. You got to find the things that you're good at. You got to find, A, what you're good at, and B, what the potential things are. If there's not something like within your current position or the niche you kind of fill, is it being fulfilled in your organization or within your crew or not? That's the things you got to look for. I think. Like, for example, like there has to be somebody within your crew, like just in modern firefighting, you have to have people on your, you have to be at least somewhat knowledgeable about EMS work, about medical work, whether you like it or not. You can choose not to like it. And believe me, like I'm just like everybody else, where you go on those 2 a.m., 1 a.m., or whatever chest pain calls that aren't really, four cars in the driveway, this and that. I hate that just as much as next guy. You go in a house full of people and you're picking up a 180-pound person. You're like, why am I doing this? But there are gonna be those times when you have an opportunity to make a real difference, when you go in there, and sometimes it could be that breathing problems call. You go in there and like, oh, you know, seriously, like, and you go there and it really is a medical emergency. And depending on your organization, like ours, where, you know, there's way more firefighters than there are EMS, it could be a little bit. And if you don't have that knowledge base, then you're a liability. You're a liability in that position, especially if you're that guy. And I think you have to find that. But if that is the position needs filled, then you have to fill that position. And it doesn't mean, well, not, oh God, I don't want to be the guy that just good at medical stuff. You know, everybody's gonna make memes about me. Well, I didn't say that. I'm just saying that that is one of the roles that you might have to fill. Right? You have to look at where the gaps and where the weaknesses are within, you know, your company, your organization, your region, and you have to work on them. It's one of the reasons that I, it seems strange that a guy who's into engine work is also into auto extrication, but I am. And one of the things when it came to auto extrication is I was very observant in the fact that, man, I would love to go just like you, right? I would love to go fight fires every day, go in there, make grabs, get on the, you know, get on the hand line, put the fire out. That's the stuff I want to do. What firefighter doesn't want to do that? But what I realized is within our organization, we have just as much opportunity to affect rescue, and really not even just as much, much, much more opportunity to affect rescue when it comes to auto extrication. And I think profession-wide, that's actually true for a lot of people. Especially within Lexington County, where, you know, on top of having actual interstates running through the county, I-77, I-20, I-26, you have a lot of like smaller highways that run through that are, you know, death traps, you know, Highway 6, 302, 321, 178, 378. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Those backcountry highways where people take turns too fast, people aren't paying attention, oncoming lanes. I've had so many opportunities for auto extrication. It was never something I thought we'd be good at because, again, going back, I'm not the guy for mechanical stuff. So I'm not going to be one out there changing oil in my car and all this other stuff. You're lucky if you get me out there to change a tire, and I might be good enough to do that. But the opportunity persisted to make those effects. And I had some calls, like I'm sure you've had, and you know, everybody who's honest with themselves. I had some calls, you know, in my career where like I didn't like how that went. I did not like how that happened. And I think too often when it comes to experience in this organization, like again, this is where I kind of correct people on experience. Experience is super valuable. Experience is everything we do. However, like if you don't gain anything from that experience, if you're not your own self-critic, then what was the point of any of that? And I went on those calls and I was like, I didn't feel good about that. I think we could have done better. I'm honest with myself. And I am my own like worst critic for better or worse. So for me, that's what I gravitate. I saw the potential. I saw the weakness. I was like, I want to go get better at that. I want to read the articles. I want to watch the videos. I want to do the classes. And that's how you get better at this stuff. The biggest thing I can offer to people, and this is a really, you know, drawn out answer, like go back and what are your resources? You know, do the resources operate within the company or not? You know, because and this is not a slight to anybody. But you know this just like I do, especially talking to people, going to conferences, having these conversations. You doing your podcast, talking to people. I'm sure you had plenty of instances where guys came out of recruit class and in their probationary period were either thrown into slow companies or, you know, or with officers who just didn't care, you know, surrounded by people who just like they couldn't get in the recliner fast enough. You have to be willing to go out there on your own in the bay. And do reps on your own. You have to be willing to, if nobody else in the company wants to practice masking up, guess what? It's your responsibility. You go out there, you have those opportunities. You're supposed to check your equipment every morning, right? Get that face piece out, get your air pack on, practice it right there and then. You get one free opportunity every morning. You're supposed to flow air in that face piece. That's your opportunity, it is your responsibility. And something that's not, and it's not necessarily fair. But it's the truth. And I think that's where you need to do is you need to look for your resources. Like you asked earlier on, talk about mentors. If you have a mentor, reach out to them, talk to his mentor. What a great resource, because I think the fire service, there's two things as far as people go that it's lacking: mentors and good trainers. Like sometimes their trainers are right there and they just, and other times you can't find somebody who's good at one single thing you want to be good at. Like here's one, somebody that's good at RIT. You'd be surprised to find how few people are actually really good at RIT, but they're out there. So where's your resources at? Go look at Rob Ramirez, go to a Mandy Mindset class, something I want to do because I need to be good at first arriving fire ground skills. I'm in an organization with currently, what, four trucks in it? That's it. 25 stations, single apparatus per station, essentially, no multi-company at the station. So I have to be good at first arriving skills, So you look at your resources, whether it's a mentor, whether it's the videos, whether it's the conferences, whether it's the outside training, find those resources that are going to fill those gaps, allow you to look and like observe and be like, where is my weaknesses at? Or where is the organization? Or where is my company's weaknesses at? And be honest with yourself. They might not like it. So be careful with how you leverage these words against people around you because you might shut them off to you, but it doesn't stop you from being responsible for your own training and your own abilities. So that's where I would take that one. Look, find your resources. Social media, there's good and bad videos out there, but there's a lot of good videos out there these days. And they get a lot of feedback and they get a lot of follows and a lot of, sometimes all those comments aren't good, but some of those people get a lot of follows for a reason. I would go out there and I would start using my resources that are available to me.
Okay. All right. Love the answer. What does the term aggressive mean to you personally?
Okay, so this one, I think, the way I answer this one is we know those guys who deem themselves aggressive firefighters, they get it, and that's fine. They get out the truck running, they got tools in their hand, they're in the door real quick, and hey, I like it. I like it. And I'm not, and somebody might hear with my tone right now, I might think I'm about to say, don't run in the fire ground. Nope, that's not what I'm saying at all. But I think you have to have, when you're going up there and being aggressive, it should, your decisions that you're making in the moment and your choices to like make these aggressive decisions need to be informed by, again, those three things that you rely on: your training, your experience, and your ability to problem solve. And remember, you could control the training. So if you're one of those guys who like really doesn't do anything all shift, right? But when the tones drop, that's when I turn it on. To me, from somebody who comes from MMA and has to deal with a lot of silly opinions, and really that's in any profession, any hobby, you're gonna have a lot of silly, just dumb opinions, is it really sounds like the dude who like, hey man, like have you ever considered like doing some jiu-jitsu training, going to, going to a Muay Thai class, whatever it is. I mean, there's a gym right over here. I know these guys. And the guy responds by telling you, oh, I don't really need that, man. I just see red, bro. Like, I those type of guys really exist everywhere in what we do. And I think some of those guys who are aggressive are those type of guys. They're the I see red guys. When the tones drop, I turn it on. If you're not learning from your training to kind of build some, practice skills, if you're not learning from your experience, like I don't like how that happened, like I need to operate at a high level. Yeah, okay, maybe this house was going to burn down. Maybe this grab wasn't going to happen because they were already in the fire room. Don't sell yourself short and operate at a lower level because of that. Operate at the highest level. Always try to act, act and operate at the highest level. And that's what I think an aggressive firefighter does. They're training hard. And they're working hard and pushing hard when it comes to, when it comes to the calls. They're not just the guy that turns it on, and they're not being dumb. They're not doing stupid firefighting. They're not getting themselves in trouble for no reason. They're not being a liability because aggressive firefighting, when it's done badly, can be a liability to the entire operation for itself because we're all part of a mission on the fire ground, right? Again, that's why we have those people, why we have the truck companies, the engine companies, why we have those roles and those first arriving skills, why we have a RIT team, why we send people to the roof, why we do aggressive search because we know aggressive search is so important. We have those roles we got to fill. And I think guys forget that sometimes. And I think they just, fight fire like idiots sometimes. And I think we need to practice like effectively. I think guys need to train effectively. I think they need to learn from that experience. And I think based on those two things, now they have the ability to problem solve. So that's aggressive firefighting, is that we're, I'm not saying anything we haven't heard before, right? We always revert to the lowest level of training. We always do. We always do. We always, again, so those guys who just turn it on, that's a bunch of crap. I don't agree with it. I do think some people just perform better in the moment. Like, again, I feel like that's where the one of the reasons I like firefighting so much is like in that moment, I feel my best, but it's not an excuse to not to train and learn from your experiences. So that's aggressive firefighting, is the guy that can do those things and then move quickly and effectively on the fire ground.
Okay. Where's the question? Just had it. All right, got it. Realistic training on a small budget. Now, I'm not sure what the budget is for Lexington, but unfortunately, we do have some organizations, some departments that don't have like their own training ground, their own training drill. So, what ideas do you do? Can you share out to those who might be in that situation?
Right. So this is an important one. You have to be able to train within your company level at your station. If you can't do that, then you're really limiting yourself. If it can only happen on the training ground, if it can only happen when I, go to classes, it's not enough. It's not enough. Again, there's too much in this profession. There's too many things that we can always constantly improve at for us not to train on a regular basis. People who don't train on a regular basis are an absolute liability every single time. I promise you, they're an absolute liability. And I know I don't need to convince you of this. I know you train hard, but we need to pass this message on to others. So for me, and just to get my, okay, so everyone, like, this is why sometimes, there was a question you had about promotions, and that's a tough question because it's so organization dependent, right? And it's tough for me to say, well, this is for me, because then if you're an organization a quarter of the size, it doesn't work like that. So for me, like, this is what I have currently in Lexington. So Lexington does have a training ground, a pretty nice training ground. Lexington does, but again, Lexington is, so back up a little bit. It has one training ground. Lexington County, and forgive me if I'm wrong about this, somebody will correct me offline, has about 750 square miles. It is absolutely massive. It's not reasonable for people, like, I worked at a station for a while when I got promoted to captain. The training grounds were literally my first due. So for me, there was no excuse to use it, not to use the training grounds a lot, like, but it's not fair for me to assume that somebody, like, at the end of the county for us to be like a Mac Edisto, Sandy Run, or Chapin for, on the other side of Lake Murray. Like, it's not reasonable for me to assume that they can make it to the training grounds on a regular basis. So we have to find training at the company level. And I think it's really important, whether you're resourceful enough or not, to be able to be willing to build your own things at the station. For me, again, getting exposed to the outside training and the guys like Jonah and them, hose props were a big one. Hose props were a big one. It was something we did not have, I don't think, in a single station. Somebody will correct me. Well, back in 26 or 2012, well, I get it. From my perspective, from what I saw, we didn't have any hose props in the station. So what happens when you don't have a hose prop, right? Well, you don't want to practice stretching, because what if I get a call? I don't, if I pull off my truck, I could get called. Some people will, plenty of guys will tell you, well, that's a crap excuse. And I agree, right? But if you run a hose load that's like a triple fold or something like that, that is inherently kind of difficult to pack, and somebody will tell me that's not true, I disagree. You're not going to want to stretch it in training, right? So you need stuff like a hose prop in the bay to practice your pulls, stuff like that. Like, just get resourceful enough to bring in some tools that you or somebody in your company or somebody on one of the shifts, the three shifts at your station, or how many shifts you have, is going to ever have, and be willing to build props and do stuff like that. Look up, again, building those networking those resources. Like, hey, I want to build something like this. What are your thoughts? How do I best handle this? You'd be surprised at the resources that people have. And For me, like, it all started with building hose props. Like, dude, I'm telling you, I'm not a handyman, but as a grown adult, as a husband and a father, like, I had to learn how to do things. And I took the crappy little drill I had, brought some screws in, and with Lexington growing so rapidly, you could find a subdivision everywhere. Well, let me rephrase that. Or a housing development under some level of construction, right? So the houses are still getting built. So what does that mean to you? There are going to be dumpsters filled with junk wood. So we sent people out when I was, down in South Congaree, Station 5 in Lexington, and they went out and they just grabbed a whole bunch of junk wood, some 2x4s, some 4x4s, well, not 4x4s, but some 2x4s, some plywood and stuff like that, stuff they were just throwing away, but you piece together and you could build something out of that. And it costs you nothing. Some pallets, they cost you nothing. We at our training grounds, we got hundreds of pallets. I mean, if you go to Nozzle Ford, and then you get access to all of their information on their website, they show you how to just marry some pallets up together, which you can then in turn build into hallways or whatever you want to do with that little, marry those pallets together. So I don't have hallways. How do I practice hallway work? Well, you build them. Well, I can't go out and buy, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars of plywood. Well, nobody asked you to do that, but do you have access to a bunch of pallets? Well, there's a possibility there. Could you practice roof venting, or at least the positioning and the angle of the footwork on a set of pallets? You could. Is it the same thing as a roof? No. So at a certain point in time, you got to find time to get to a roof, even if it's on the training grounds, to get that work in. But you have to be willing to, again, it goes back to being a better firefighter, and how do you get better at the company level and fill those niches? Like, again, look at your resources. Look at those resources around you. Heck, I've known guys who are like, they may be disgruntled. They may be that guy who, like, you pitch change and it's a huge mistake because they're just going to give you heartache and you're going to be really mad that you wasted that time with them. But they might be that guy who, like, offline, they're the greatest dude in the world. And if you set them on a project, all of a sudden, the guy who doesn't like training, who isn't into the change, he might help you build that prop because he's, from 4 years old, that's all he's ever done at his little country home with his dad, and now he's got a side business like that. So use those resources available to you. Build yourself props. Social media is a great resource for this. I see things, guys doing things like in their training. I'm like, oh wow, that's really smart and intelligent. Again, as an engine guy, and I had a great opportunity when we went out and changed hose loads recently. We went to Minuteman's for everything over the past year. Everything had a Minuteman style pull, depending on what type of load, whether it was a bundle or 300-foot line for us or a crosslay. One of the things I talked to guys about is because our hose is not great and we're working on that, it gets busted all the time, holes in all the time. Well, logistics is going to throw that away for us. But if you don't have hose in the station to train on, why are you, if they're going to throw it away, like, hey, we need some new hose, but I'm going to keep this right here. Don't worry about it. Just let them know what you're going to do because I'm going to keep this. I'm going to use this on my crop. Or, like I told guys, I'm like, go out into your district. And if you're afraid to pull a line, out in your district, why not take 100 foot of hose with you out to an apartment area and just get on that landing and practice your deployment? What kind of effective deployment can I do in this landing with a 100 foot shoulder bundle, using our example of the Minuteman, and practice that deployment? That costs nothing. Costs $0 to you. And guess what? You're getting paid on duty anyways. So those opportunities do exist. And again, you follow a lot of the same accounts, I'm sure. You've seen a lot of the same stuff I do. Like, you're on these med runs, you're on these lift assists. It's an opportunity. Sometimes you don't even have to pull a line. Just like, look, just stand there and look. You pick the person up, or you've got them loaded on the ambulance, and just turn around and stop and just look at the house. Okay. If I look at this house, all right, where are they likely to be at? Where's my likely stretching opportunities? What are going to be some problems for me? Is this good apparatus placement right now? Where would the apparatus be raised, realistically placed? Where am I going to tell the truck to go? Look around. Where are the hydrants at my area? Do I have a hydrant or am I rural water supply? 80% of, just spitballing here, 70 to 80% of my county could be rural depending on where you're at. So where am I going for water supply if this house is burning right now? That's a free training opportunity, and you're building those neural connections right there for when it does go down in the middle of the night and you have to make those decisions on the fly. Again, that third part, your ability to problem solve. Those things cost nothing. Be resourceful. Try to build things in the station. Look up ways to train, masking up drills, stuff like that. Do practice those skills that'll turn into drills. Again, you worked with the nozzle forward. You were, I'm sure, in Aaron's lecture where he talked about how to build skills and the drills, working the skills, building the drills. You can do that at company level all day long. Combine masking up until, throw a ladder, then mask up. Force a door, then mask up. Stretch a line, mask up. Those are things you can build into drills. And again, they cost nothing for you to do. Get out into your district. Does the engineer know the response area? Where are your hydrants at? Because not everybody's blessed to have hydrants at. So where are my best water resources? Let's set these things up. Those things cost nothing to do. It's just a little bit of energy at a time, a little bit of creativity, and just plan for it. If you plan for it a little bit, then all these things work out. Don't go overboard. Don't plan. If you got, for me, example, what is it, 10 shifts a month, one day on, 2 days off. I would be careful planning for 10 days of training because calls are calls and responsibilities are responsibilities. But let's say I have a goal for 3 to 6 training sessions and they're going to be these things. Plan for those and use your resources available, and you'd be surprised at what you can get done.
With you being a company officer, in your opinion, what does leadership look like to you? What does a leader look like, and what are they supposed to pretty much? How is a leader supposed to act?
Well, leaders are supposed to set examples. That's like the first thing you're looking at is you're trying to set it like an example for a company level, or for me in my position at the company level. So you're supposed to set those examples, and so some people take this too far, but sometimes that means you have to be a bad guy, and that doesn't mean you're drop and what. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying you have to drop the hammer every time, but sometimes the boys. Trying to be politically correct, but boys and girls, but like, you know what I mean? Like, they don't feel like doing things, but like, at some point, you got to be the bad guy. Like, okay, sorry, too bad. I don't care how you, I plan for training today. I don't care what you did last night. That's not my problem. Like, I got to get out there and we're going to get some training done. And that's flip flop, right? Because we have our bad days too. And as a company officer, you can't be that guy like, well, I feel like crap today. So forget it. We're going to hide inside all day long because I just got a crappy night's sleep last night. Well, that's a terrible excuse. You got to kind of balance things out sometimes and know your people. But, one of the things I tell guys, I started doing this as an engineer because I understand in my organization we still have 2-person stations, we're getting to where almost every station has 3 people, an officer at every station, but we're not there yet. So as an engineer, I was that senior person at that station, and if I got mandatory overtime is a reality for these days. Like, it's a reality, and sometimes it's an ugly reality depending on your organization. You can't be that guy who like, oh, okay, I got mandatory today, so screw it. I get there, I'm gonna throw my stuff in the truck if I even take it out the bag, and then I'm gonna sit in there and I hope I have an office because they, I'm gonna shut that door and they don't know what I'm doing in there, which is definitely sleeping. That's not fair to them. They didn't ask for that, and so especially if you got a guy who's looking to develop himself. Like, that's not fair to them at all because that's a day lost to them. And sometimes you're in these places where somebody could be on light duty or out for a while, where Every shift, they got somebody new, right? They don't ever have the same. Now, sometimes they get guys in perna rideout positions, but sometimes it's not like that. Sometimes they're not available. So they get that constant overtime guy. So how is it fair to them that, God, who am I going to get today? And what is he not going to feel like doing? Is he even
Right.
going to check the truck? You know, because like
Right.
again, guys are mad, or sometimes, truth be told, they are the guy that signs up for overtime, but they're an absolute liability. That's not fair as an officer. Like, you have to be willing to show up and put forth the work for those guys, and you have to be willing to lead, and you have to be willing to direct that training. You have a responsibility to them, like to them and the citizens. Like, you are the number one guy at that company level for, and again, using my example as a captain within a company in my organization, you have an absolute responsibility. And that's what it looks like. You're setting an example and you're leading the guys and you're developing them, you know, and that could be difficult. Like, I end up positions a lot because we're a rapidly growing organization where I have an engineer in some sort of stage of development in his career where he's new, or whether he's trying to look into be a captain himself. And I might have a probationary firefighter. You know, how do you juggle those responsibilities? Well, it doesn't matter. That's my problem to deal with, whether I like it or not. You know, like I tell people with HOSOs, I'm not going to show up tomorrow. Hey, you like the Minuteman? Well, that's great. Guess what's going to happen tomorrow? You're going to have your hose load. It's your responsibility to maximize that hose load, like it or not. And it's the same thing as an officer, like it or not, whether I want a senior man on my truck to help kind of mentor that firefighter. And so we kind of develop better as a company. Well, I get that or I don't. I have that responsibility. I set that example. And that's what you owe the guys as an officer. You owe that so much. Don't show up on overtime and not think you owe them something because you know you got mandatory, or you're doing the organization a favor by filling a seat. That's the wrong answer. Again, what did you get in this profession for? So for the guys, for the gals, like, I really, you owe them your time and your abilities. One of the things I would do when I show up on overtime, or you know, get mandatory, because I don't do a lot of overtime. It's just me. I don't need the money. Like, I got my days off. I'm going to use them. But when I do the overtime, or I get mandatory, like especially mandatory, I show up and I'm like, "What do you? Is there anything you want to do today? Is there anything you want to do? What do we need to work on?" A lot of times the guys will say, "No, you know, I'm fine, everything. Maybe you find something to do anyways." Or sometimes they'll be like, "Hey, you know, I'm working on my packet to be an engineer. Like, I've been a cap, I've been getting floated around a lot. It's been hard for me to get these things done." Okay, I got you. We get some free time today. Like, we got some things to do this morning. We get some free time. We're gonna sit down, we're gonna look at your packet, and we're gonna see what we can do today. Like, I've done that for guys, you know. That's the thing you owe them as an officer. You owe them your time and like your ability that you've accrued to your point of career. Again, that experience that should matter. You know, those are things you owe them. You owe to them that, and in turn, that just provides for the citizens in the end, right? You're doing your best thing for those citizens. So I think that's what you owe them. For the guys, you owe them your time and your abilities. And if you're not developing them, then again, it goes back all the way back to where I talked about at the beginning. Where are those mentors at? You know, like, where are those mentors at? We have, I think, sometimes a mentorship problem. We have
Right.
a trainer problem. And again, asking like the question you asked earlier, how can we fill those roles? Well, those are two roles that are easily filled. I try to do that for people. Like, people call me sometimes, text me, like, "Man, what a great thing that they are saying about you." You know, as you know, for me as an officer, like, hey, Cap, you know, blah blah blah, or hey, like, hey, we're doing this thing. What a great responsibility you have. Like, what have you done to get to that point? Like, it's such a blessing. Like, I should be happy with that, and I should be ready to pass that on. I think, again, we just lose perspective. We forget about, you know, what we're doing and what we're doing this profession for. So, again, as an officer, it just means everything. It means everything to people. You have every responsibility to guys, and most importantly, just getting them home every shift. Like, at the end of every shift, I know safety culture is very controversial these days, and because it's applied, and you know, we as we know, instead of applying it, you know, the right way, we're applying it and like we want to protect the organization, which is a bunch of crap. We know that's a bunch of crap, but like, but that being said, we do owe a responsibility that our guys need to return home. So you owe it to them to make sure you're maximizing your training abilities. They're the best firefighters they can be within their position. And also you're working on their career development. So when they become, when they're no longer underneath you, they pass on that same knowledge because you set the example of what an officer should be. Because when they were underneath of you, we were training, we were learning, we were reading, you know, we were talking about the job, we were out in our district. You know, these are things that we did because then they, that's, and whether you like it or not, that's how they're going to be. They're not exactly, they're not you, they're not clones, but that is how they're going to, you're going to influence them in some sort of way. You're going to influence that future behavior within them.
Okay. And with your background of being in the armed forces and jujitsu and things and martial arts, the topic of physical fitness, I feel like it's a topic that some organizations and departments don't want to speak on because they're afraid to, whether you want to say hurt someone's feelings or let them know, hey, your appearance right now is not up to par with what it should be. So with that being said, how important is physical fitness to you doing this job?
Oh, it's super important. You know, I'm one of those guys that no matter what, like I'm going to do some sort of physical activity. It's just how I am. Like I don't see myself not doing it. So I have to find ways to relate people who don't live like that and it be and explain the importance of it. Because for me, like I'm going to have some level of like physical fitness about me. Like I lift 4 days a week. Like it's non-negotiable for me. Like 4 days a week, I'm getting my lift in. Now, part of the reason I follow that schedule is because it's time with my wife. Like me and her, she, me and her, like, you know, we like lifting together. We like that time together. So if we're going to work out, we enjoy doing it together. It's one of the reasons that, you know, martial arts, jiu-jitsu kind of took a back seat for me, you know, the, you know, past 6 months because like it was just too much for me. And, but inherently through those things, I was, you know, martial arts and especially MMA, like I was in, at such a great level of physical fitness, even if I didn't realize it. For me, I'm like, oh, I could always be better. Again, you know, sometimes I'm a terrible critic of myself, but I like, you know, if you're competitive, then you're always like, well, it's never enough, you know? So for me, it's like as a lifestyle, you know, you had a guy on, I don't know, for, let's call it 3 to 6 months ago, Riley Kilbride, like, that guy is an absolute monster when it comes to physical fitness. Like his biggest goal in life, you know, as far as a firefighter goes, is to be a Georgia smoke diver, full stop. I mean, he was you know, he trained he, and he was exposed to that and he started training with Jay Moeller. And, you know, we know what happened with firefighter Moeller. And that, you know, that had an even bigger impact on Kilbride because, you know, he was working with them and training with the build to that. And now it means so much more to Riley, you know? So for guys like him, like that's what I look up to. I'm like, man, I'm not doing enough. I know I do a lot of strength-based stuff and conditioning is so important. Like I can, you know, if I can pick up a truck, it means nothing if I'm panting and wheezing after stretching a line and going 3 feet in the door, you know? So guys can be, look in shape or not even be heavy because you talk about appearance and like that's one way to look at somebody because like it is indicative of like their fit, you know, their behavior. But sometimes those guys who like they're not they don't look to be in terrible shape, you know. Maybe they're really strong guys even like again like you know like they lift a lot of weights, you know, they might power lift or something like that. But if you're still a liability when you get in that door after you're doing two skills, then what was the point of any of that? And I think one of the things we're making you know, in this profession where, you know, we got to be really careful about this is we got to stop compromising our standards. And this is an easy thing to say, but there's got to be a balance to this because it's like I you know we always got to look for perspective. One of the things I always try to look for is perspective on what everybody's doing. Like if I was a chief, Like, why would I be making these decisions? And I'm like, well, man, I, talking, especially if you talk to these guys, you're like, man, if I was there, everybody would probably hate me too, because I would have to make some really hard decisions, because it just does this for the organization, whether they like it or not. But when we compromise the physical standards for the organization so much, then if we care about safety, like I've been thinking about that a lot lately. If we care about safety so much, right? And again, are we really trying to protect the organization, or are we actually trying to be safe and just, and still be good at the job but be safe? I feel like those are two different things. Because like, if your thing is like, well, I can point to this piece of paper, or I could point to this physical thing and say, oh, look, we adhere to those things, then you don't really care about safety. You're just trying to protect yourself. What a bunch of crap. Like that, to me, that doesn't work out. I don't jive with that. And I think, like, so if you're dropping the physical standards, then I really question whether you care about the safety or not. Now, maybe you're saying like, okay, they're incredibly high. Maybe we came up with a physical agility test that was like, and that, it sounded good in practice, but on paper, but then in practice, it's not, it's like, it's really like been too much. Okay. Well, again, perspective, maybe I'm wrong, but we can't compromise standards. Like, there has to be a balance to this. And I think we're sometimes compromising standards because to like go shoot for a lower level of physical ability. To basically, we're lowering the bar for physical ability in the profession. And I think that's the wrong answer. And it goes back to like one of the questions you asked. I don't know how well I can influence things at an organization level for that. But for a company level, we can influence some things. We gotta have, and that's gonna re if we're willing to have hard conversations and be critical of how we perform in the fire ground, and just healthy criticism, then we have to be willing to do that same thing for physical fitness. Like, and sometimes that's self-talk, right? Like, if you get in there and you're on the line and you're panting and wheezing, but hey, just like before the fire went out, nobody got injured. Does that, again, that's like the what they was that's a participation trophy, right? That's, and I'm just paraphrasing there, that's not my quote, but like that is a participation trophy in our field. And why would you accept that if you're that guy and you have to take some self-responsibility? Like, man, that was really bad. Like, if I was asked to drag somebody out there, would I fall out myself? And you can't be that liability. So we have to take some responsibility for ourselves. But if you're like in my position, you have to be responsible for others too. And sometimes that means it has to be a hard conversation. And again, you might have to be that bad guy as an officer. That's when you tell those guys, okay, you know what? Like usual, I'm going to go outside and I'm going to work out. Y'all are going to come out there and do something. We're doing something out there. I don't care what. And they can't really say no to you. Now it doesn't mean you kill your guys. Be responsible. But if they get out there and move a little bit, you'd be surprised what guys do. And once they just sometimes just getting out there and they start moving. And then the pace starts picking up, and they start trying to do things. They start emulating you, and it's just, you gotta be willing to be that bad guy sometimes, and be like, "Let's come on, let's go out there and do this." And then they're willing to do it, like, but like, hey, Cap, because it's South Carolina, and you're only up the road a little bit, so you know how hot it gets. Like, be responsible, like that might mean like, okay, I don't care, I'll work out in the heat. But that might not be fair to these guys, and it might make them a liability if we get a call while we're out there in that heat, right? But if we can, hey, after truck checks, or before breakfast or after breakfast, do you guys want to? Would this work better for you guys? Yes, okay. Or do you? Most guys don't want to lift in the evening because, like, if you postpone it too far, then you might not get the lift at all because of the calls. But if you can set that time aside for you guys, so for me, at the company level, that's your best opportunity to influence those around you. You can look at those guys that are heavy and you can be critical, but at organization level, that could be a tough influence. Raising the bar for entry, that's a tough ask, man. Like that goes into some real serious issues that might go beyond the organization itself, but at the company level, you are definitely responsible for yourself and those around you. And I think you can influence them. And sometimes it's not just being a bad guy, it's just encouragement. Like, let's just get out there and do something. And again, you'd be surprised what guys will do. Like, and sometimes it reveals itself through skill work. A ladder throws are an easy one. Go throw that 28 and they're just teeter-tottering and falling over the place. Wrong answer. We need to get stronger, or we just need to, technique trumps everything, right? That's technique and
Absolutely.
leverage. So, I mean, it balances hand in hand there. And could you make that technique work part of your strength conditioning? Absolutely. Because you do enough reps and you set a standard to it with some time, and it could be some exhausting work. Now, there's a place for just actual strength conditioning too, but I think we can balance those two things and work them together. So at the company level, to quote Kilbride, it's non-negotiable. Like, you should be able to manage at your level. You can't fix everybody around you, but you can definitely fix yourself and those guys that you work with.
Damn right. Absolutely spot on. Spot on, Cap. All right. I normally would ask, but I already know the answer. I was going to say, are you an engine guy or a ladder guy? But you specifically put on their engine work. So for the last topic, why is engine work important, and what part of engine work do you like?
So, and for me, the engine work is so obvious, and this is you get in these conversations, and there's healthy trash talk in the profession. That's fine. Like, it's part of the profession. Like, I was in the Army and I was in a combat MOS where like trash talk is a norm. Sometimes it goes too far, but it can be healthy, and especially and competition is definitely healthy. And I think that's where a lot of that stuff comes from. It's like you do this, I do that. This is why this is important. And you, we know, I viewed it a little bit less negatively. I think everybody has a role, but it's fine. For me, fire attack, like, it's when I got into the profession, like, that's what I viewed it as. Like, I guess everybody has their own thing, their own why, especially if they had they have like a family history, which I didn't, obviously, but like they can have certain views on it. But for me, like fire attack is like what firefighting is. It's you're putting out the fire. Like, that's what the citizen expects to see. Now, some people are like, okay, well, what about pulling people out of windows? Yeah, like that's rescue is a huge part of it. And a lot of our most biggest symbols and for the profession is somebody carrying victims out and all that. So it is part of like firefighting. But like, and again, just paraphrasing here, we nothing improves the conditions more than putting out the fire. Like, so it was the first thing I was exposed to was that fire attack. Like, as far as engine work was like the first, again, going back to Jonah, and JJ's a truck guy, truck guy through and through. A lot of what his teaching is just truck work, but he has brought me in to help teach with the engine stuff too sometimes. But like, for me, like getting exposed to engine work, it was the first thing I was really exposed to. And one of the first things I started questioning was like, there's got to be better hose loads out there. And there's got to be more. We should be able to train and stretching hose more often. Why don't we do that? So, and the stretch is a first part of of everything on like I'm putting out the fire as far as fire attack goes. So for me, like the two things that I put most importance to on fire attack is A, the stretch, because everything starts with a stretch. Everything starts at that first line. Like everything, going back to Andy Fredericks, like, everything goes with that first line. So you can be so good at everything else, but if your stretch is crap, if there's a hose is kinked up, if it's all knotted up, if it's to the wrong door, like everything gets objectively worse from there. It's like starting with like a it's like being a football player and starting with a 15-yard penalty, every time you play. Why would you do that? Like, just stop having less penalties. So, and then the second part for me is nozzle work is awesome. And a lot of what we do I mean, you know, when again going to, but you know, nozzle forward, talking about knee walk and clamp slide, all that stuff that we do, all those different movements in and out of nozzle forward, and you know, the different engine schools you go to, it comprises so much of it. But for me, the backup man is everything. Everything, everything, everything. Like I, you know, in my own organization with recruits, we've been building an engine school. It started off with 2 days. And again, this goes, you know, this is another example of how you can influence change. There's an opportunity for me. There was an opportunity and I took it. The two, you know, it's just a little 2 day engine school. That last recruit class is 3. And now it's going to be 4 days after this, you know, because like, again, I've shown the knowledge base. But like, one of the things I talk to the recruits about, or just if I'm out there teaching in an outside class or a conference, you know, as I start doing those more and more often, you can be the world's best nozzleman. You can be the greatest nozzleman in the world. If you have a really bad backup, it doesn't matter. If you hit every pinch point, if he's not going to help you the line, then why does it even matter? You're not going to get to see the fire. It's going to get in that ceiling and it's going to do things. It's going to advance, and you know, you're going to burn the house down or something really bad is going to happen. That backup man is so important. And I tell people, and this isn't one of those guys who are just saying things just to say it, like I really do enjoy being a backup man. I really, really enjoy it. Like I love it. And I'm not just saying it to kind of encourage people to be better at it. I love it because I get to dictate the pace of the line. Like I know that the nozzle is getting to the fire because of what I am doing as a backup man. If I am a bad backup man, it's not happening unless the fire is right there. So, and those are, and again, the stretch leads into that as well, right? If you have a bad stretch and the first thing you do is create a pinch point, because for some reason, instead of going in line with the door, because you could go in line with the door because it's available to use a straight runway, for some reason, you just kind of lay everything off to a 90 off the porch and with no reason of mind. And the first thing you do is create 3 pinch points. Man, that's a problem. And then if you're a bad backup man, that's a problem. So for me, those are the two most important aspects of engine work, is you have to be good at the stretch and you have to be a good backup man. Be a good nozzle man because that's what puts a fire out. But a backup man gets you to the fire. Good work. And again, work on your straight sticking, work on your backup man roles, you know, like all those things, those vocabulary words that, as Aaron will tell you, they're so important to us. Like those are the things you need to be good at engine work. To be the actual, if we're talking about the actual skill work of engine work, to me, those two things, the stretch and the backup role, they're everything. They're everything to putting out the fire. And that's why I got so into it. And just, you know, what, you know, one other thing that got me into, you know, what on the nozzle work was that knee walking. Kind of like somebody demoed a knee walk. It was, I don't know if it was Jonah or somebody else. And coming from jujitsu or MMA, I was like, that's a double leg. That's exactly how you shoot a double leg. I was like, what? I was like, and I think that's where Aaron, either, you know, Aaron having that judo background, or you know, one of his guys around him who had a wrestling or jiu-jitsu background, was like, well, look, check this thing out. Like I can move like a wrestler and advance this line. And man, I was like, oh, I can do that naturally. And that just got me into it. And that's just like a little sidebar. But really for me, like as far as what's absolutely important is those two things. Those that backup man and that stretch.
And that's one thing for sure. You know, anytime you have a really good fire and the fire gets put out, you know, all the credit goes to the nozzleman. But in reality, and even I've said this, the backup man doesn't get the credit that he deserves. But he has to be a true backup. He has to be a true good backup man, because most characteristics of firefighters that I know of, it's going to be really hard if you have to hold the nozzle, make a push, and drag 200 foot of inches and a quarter by yourself. Like, you have that person, like you said, pinch points, turns, they need to be able to communicate. Without a good backup man to give you that slack, to give you that hose that you need where you can move and put that fire out, it's huge, and it goes unnoticed until something goes bad. And it's just, I kind of compare it with engineers and drivers. Fire goes out. Hey, did you, fire went out. Everything was good. But the driver, what you didn't see, the driver made sure he caught his own water supply. He had it established. You were good to go. You never had any fluctuation in your pressure. But if something goes bad, everybody's going to look at the driver. So it's just like, if everything goes bad, hey, where's your backup guy? Man, I got caught up in this. So I like how you mention that, because I think it's one of those things that doesn't get enough credit, is the backup man for sure.
Yeah, and those roles too, right? Man, talk the like people like if you're going to be good at engine work, then what's part two to that that we need to be good at? Well, one of the things I would say is that engineer role. If you have an engineer that pumps the line like a jerk and just says, "Whoa, just man up, like stop," you know what? You need some retraining because you see those guys. It's like, how can we be so into skill work and like as an engineer, like, oh, you're doing all your calculations and everything like that, and then you just tell somebody to man up, like nozzle reaction isn't a real thing. Like, no, nah, and like I've advocated this a lot on my engineers, and I've been on fires recently, but man, I'm really happy with what the engineer has done. Like a guy I want to shout out, we had a fire recently that was a tough one, and it didn't go the way we wanted to, but as far as what he did, guy named Devin Mulhern, young engineer, or not even engineer, I think he's riding up actually. He went out, we had to reposition a line because like we had to cut a gate, lock through a fence to get to something. He pulled another line by himself. He grabbed tools. He was managing water supply, multiple lines were on the ground. You like part two to good engine work as far as everything goes is how you actually move the water. And again, knowing why we do things, more going beyond that skill work and advocating for change, like Dennis Aguirre, like hydrants to nozzles, great class. If I could do his class again, if I could bring him in for the class, oh man, what a resource. Like his 2-day hydrants to nozzle class, that's the one I want. And the ability to move water is part two to everything. That's why you got to have a good engineer. Like again, everybody has a role, everybody has a position, and we all have that one mission, which is, get the victims out there and put the fire out. And that's why we all work together. That's why the truck work is so relevant. That's why the engine work is so relevant. That's why each and individual role within those companies is so important to you. So yeah, big ups to the engineer because again, and some guys and a lot of guys, they hate it when they get promoted engineer, right? Because it's like, because that means a lot of times, the fire is going on, they might be at the pump panel.
Standing outside,
And,
right.
but for them, that first 5 minutes, man, what an absolute asset they can be, and they can get so much done. So yeah, like the next 45 minutes, like you might be not doing much. Well, guess what? We really, beyond that, we're really not doing much either. Beyond that initial fire attack, beyond those initial searches, pulling ceiling, forcing doors, those things that we need to do. Like beyond that, like once we get into overhaul work, we're doing work that's not fun either, just like you just standing at the pump panel monitoring pressures. But that first 5 minutes, you're out there, you're helping us stretch lines, you're getting the hydrant, you're seeing things that we're not seeing because we're inside now. You're throwing ladders. You've seen it before. You've seen the videos I've seen where the engineer is like literally following up the hand line with a ladder on his shoulder, throwing it to the roof line. Incredible work. Incredible work. And again, like you said, guys ain't seeing that. What do they see? They see the helmet cam footage at the end of the pipe. Like that's what they see. And that's what goes on Instagram. That's what goes on the end of the year videos for organization. But an engineer, such a valuable role. It means a lot to the success or the mission that we have on the fire ground.
Definitely. And like you stated earlier, and to me, it goes with any position. You're either an asset or a liability, and choose which one you want to be, because I know I don't want to be the latter. So 100%, 100% accurate. Kat, I really appreciate you coming on, man, and talking. I know you know, behind the scenes, you were a little nervous, but dude, everything you stated is 100% factual in everything that we talked about. Like, I love the fact that you have the humility. And you want to be the best version of yourself, not only for you, but also for your organization and the crews that, you have the privilege of supervising. So I want to say thank you for coming on, man, seriously, and talking shop. It was, like I said, it was just two dudes having a conversation. It's just being recorded. But before we part out, I always I try to remember to ask, where do you see yourself? And I think I kind of know the answer, but where do you see yourself down the line to, in the fire service? Where would you like to be before you retire?
So outside of my role as a captain, because I'm pretty happy where I'm at right now, I like being an officer and I want to stay there for a while. I wouldn't mind, for my own career development, either ending up in a training division, whether it's as a training captain or as a training chief. I know training chief isn't exactly, it's not what people think it is sometimes, so maybe it might be undesirable, but but training captain or training chief, some sort of operations role, as ops chief would be interesting to me. Nothing beyond those things, I don't think, really appeals to me. Post Lexington County, I'm not sure where, we're talking for me, what, another 12 to 13 years before I reach retirement age. I don't know where I, or if there's anything beyond that for me. So I would like, as I get deeper and deeper in my career, I do enjoy helping with outside conferences and training. I really get a value out of that. Like, I really, one of the things I really enjoyed, like, doing outside conferences, doing training, like, because I know inevitably somebody's going to use those skills and it'll be a difference maker. I might not see it, I might not be told about it, but I know it's going to happen. And it's just like over the past year, this big project that we've worked on with extension bundles, with high-rise bundles, with our long lines and our cross lays. I know now every day when we're pulling lines and we're using them, it just feels good to hear it. It feels good to hear it. Maybe not everybody appreciates it. Maybe people want to go back to something, and I accept that reality. But I know there are guys who are making a difference based on those things. And just like when we, as we build engine schools in the organization, that's where I see myself. There we go. That's where I see myself, like having that big long-term effect over everybody, and like and having that positive outcome and that growth. That means everything to me. Like, that means everything to me. Like, whether I get to make those grabs, whether I make get that, those times where we're in there and we're fighting fire and we're getting in, I want those, man. I want those. But at the same time, knowing that there are other people who are getting value out of that, and they are, when they do get involved in those, it's be, at least part of it. And I'm not taking credit because they're the ones doing it, right? Like, I could teach anything, but they're the ones doing it. So they put in the energy and the time. But to be a part of that growth means everything to me. And it goes back to that mentorship. Like, that's where, like, I really see myself at, end of the career, having a good effect on mentorship, going to those outside conferences, helping people build, their own change. Like, I think, I don't know where guys like Jonah and them and JJ get the fulfillment of it, but I imagine it feels good. One of the reasons they like to do what they do is they know they're making a difference in those people who are going there, and in turn for those guys, companies, and their organizations. I think that's one of the reasons they are so, they're influencing that positive change and that positive cultural shifts. And I want to do that as well. Like, that's what I'm enjoying so much. Change for the sake of change is not good. I don't think so. But good, positive change, that's what I'd like to be a part of. So just emulating those same guys, that came before him, just like, I don't think I'll ever be an Aaron Fields or a Dennis Aguirre, but or Andy Fredericks or any of those important names of our profession. But think about what they, at the end of 20 years, or they could think about those bad calls that didn't go their way and this and that. But because that's always going to rest heavily on you, and there's nothing wrong with that as long as you can, it doesn't become super negative. But think about how, like, they can look back and like, and Darren brings this up all the time. Think about the thousands and thousands and thousands of firefighters through his nozzle four sessions, or the videos, or in turn, the good things that those people passed forward when they got the training. Literally the whole profession, really. Those are like a powerful legacy to me. is super important, like a good, powerful legacy. And not everybody's going to be happy with what you did, but that's a, you were, again, you were at the same conferences I had. And sometimes, you know, you attended Carolina Fire Days and you heard, and sometimes you have these themes and you're going to have a target on your back. All right. You're going to do something potentially wrong on a call that, you know, and people would be like, oh, see that? See that? I thought he was supposed to be good, you know. But they look, they burnt the house down. I thought they were supposed to be good. You know, what's up with that? You're gonna have a target on your back, man. Like you put yourself out there, like, you know, you get on social media, you try to teach guys, you try to influence the culture, be a mentor, you're gonna have a target on your back, and that's okay. That's okay. Except that it can hurt your feelings a little bit, you know, you're human, you know, but like be relish that legacy because the good is gonna outweigh the bad. Like if you try. And you put effort in, the good will outweigh the bad every time. So that's what I'm looking forward to is that legacy. So
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. Well said. Michael, seriously, I really do appreciate you coming on, man, spreading the good word, talking shop. You know, for those out there who might be struggling, or just to let them know, like, hey, it's okay to be alone out in the bay by yourself and training and trying to better yourself, sort of betterment of you. So once again, thank you for, you know, taking time out of your day to do this.
And I know, just real quick, you know, shout out to my wife, Anna, and the kids. I love y'all both. You know, I know they're gonna listen to this. I love all of them very much. And like everybody else knows, like having like somebody behind you, like it's so important, and it goes hand in hand too, right? Like for those of you who are like pushing real hard in this profession, and you got a wife and kids, don't forget that. Don't forget it because you're going to regret it. You're going to regret that. If you regret bad calls, you're going to regret like those times. Like, and I'm a big believer in constant improvement, and but that's not just about the profession. It's in everything that you do, right? You know, you're trying to, you know, be a better father, be a better husband. You know, if that's a role that you fill, you know, be a better spouse, whatever the roles you fill. And so just grateful because my wife, like she's, you know, she grows and improves just like I do, and her support and everything means a lot. And that allows me to do what I'm doing and enjoy what I'm doing. And the kids too, because, you know, like we try not to miss things, but sometimes it happens. But like, and you know, and we always try to be better for them. So yeah, and I know you can relate. So like
Definitely. Definitely. No, you definitely got to remember family first. I mean, you know, we all want to be really good at the job, but we got to remember what our priorities are and should be. And definitely, you know, good shout out to the spouses that let us go to these conferences, these outside training. We come back invigorated, but they're also holding down the home front while we're gone. They too, you can kind of put it in a way of they're kind of like the engineer. We don't see what's going on in the background when we're gone. So shout outs to definitely spouses, wives, husbands, girlfriends, whatever the case may be, significant others. Thank you for allowing us to do that. And Michael, like I said, thank you again for coming on.
Yes, sir, absolutely. Hey, thank you for letting me talk. And I got a lot to say. Sometimes it rambles, but I appreciate you having me on for real.
Yes,
It's good.
sir.
It was good.
Yes, sir. And shout out to before we end, I'm gonna shout out Riley. Riley's the one. Riley and hold on, I can't say that. That's wrong. It's Riley and Eric Sitch. Those two were like, hey, I got a guy for you. And I'm like, all right, shoot. And
Oh,
then they
yeah.
sent me the info. So those two made it happen. So I appreciate those guys and anybody else that throws me a bone of talking to an outstanding individual. Thank you all very much.
Yeah, and it goes back to mentorship, right? I mean, you know, part of the reason that Riley and me get along so much is like, you know, I've talked to him a lot, man. And like he like and now he's trying to, you know, him and Eric, like Eric's the man, you know, none of cakes on at the same time. That's a good dude too. Like all those people, they try to return the love, you know, and like and it's just like little stuff like that. So I try to do it too. Just give the appreciation for the people who have mentored me. That's why I'm always shouting out JJ and Jonah. And I hate to leave people out, but the list goes on and on, you know? So, yeah. Great
Absolutely.
dudes.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.